Welcome to Now Playing Podcast Book Reviews. From fiction to nonfiction, graphic novels, and more, we're here to help you find something great to read. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, Now Playing listeners. It's your faithful host, Stuart, practically jumping for joy as I welcome you back to Now Playing Book Review and back to Frank Herbert's Duneverse for a sixth, perhaps a final time. While it's true that this novel I'm here to cover, not a particularly upbeat affair, I might even be inclined to describe Chapter House Dune as a 433-page slog, yet I can't help feeling a little bit festive, a little bit giddy, because today's review completes a mission I started 7 years ago, right around this time. Back in 2017, spring, I wanted to give listeners a complete overview of the planet Arrakis as conceived by its creator, Frank Herbert. Well, friends, we've reached the end of that golden path. We're unraveling the final mysteries of that illustrious sci-fi saga with this show. Although, technically speaking, the story of Planet Dune actually wrapped up last book. I didn't want to spoil it, but the ending, it was crazy. Heretics of Dune. I try not to spoil the endings of books on the reviews of that book, but buckle up, because here it comes now. It's a doozy. In the final pages of scattered, totally bonkers Heretics of Dune, a character mentions, just in passing, by the way, Arrakis, or Rakis, whatever you want to call the planet, the only planet that's ever mattered in this saga, the spice-making desert planet, it got blown up good by the Space Horse, killing everyone and everything on the surface, which is like a whole OMG, you're kidding me, Frank Herbert really has more Dune story to tell when he wiped out spice and worms and maybe the entire Atreides line, because, well, our Atreides character for book 5 was Miles Teg, the heroic descendant of the clan who was on the surface and he was killed on Rakis too. Wow. Okay. Well, damn. That sounds like one hell of a way to shake things up and get readers started in a new creative direction. I assumed that book 6 was then going to be traveling far beyond the known universe that we've been reading for 5 novels, bring us new characters and new places, formulating a new culture, because you can't cover the same old ground when the ground literally is cosmic dust, right? It's not an option for Frank Herbert to repeat himself, nor is it within his character. Each Dune book has felt unique and singular. However, that was true until we get to book 6. I am very wrong, and one of my great disappointments with this final Chapter House Dune concerns its overwhelming focus on former glory and sentimentality. The Bene Gesserit heroes of Book 5 are going to restore everything that seems lost at the end of Book 5. Not only do they manage to escape Rakis' destruction, but they grabbed a sandworm on the way out, and so what they think is all they need to do is sprinkle some water on the worm, watch it explode into sand trout, wait for those parasites to drink up all the surrounding water, and they'll have a perfect facsimile of Arrakis and its spice production. Nothing must change. Everything has to be as it was in the past, is the mission. It's always about recreating the old empire and casting fear and hate on new things. I think that's interesting and pivotal in this story. By the way, the title, Chapter House Dune, I think of it really as an ecological aspiration. We're on the Bene Gesserit homeworld. It's called Chapter House. And what they're trying to do is turn all their greenery and apple orchards. They're hoping that all dies off so that they can recreate Rakis and the dunes. So it's really Chapter House into Dune is the transformation they're hoping to happen. Which, frankly, feels like a real head-in-the-sands move. I mean, forgive the pun, but when you kill something off, it should have stakes. You know, to bring it right back in the next book, to act as if it doesn't even matter that, by the way, at the very end of the last novel, we did something dramatic, and now we're going to totally fix it. I think that's a cheat. I mean, if the rebels blow up the Death Star, you don't just rebuild a Death Star, right? You don't have movie 3 be the Death Star's back, movie 7 the Death Star's back. All right, I'm playing. Of course, it can and has been done. It seems to me like there would be another plan. That's all I gotta say, is that other ideas are welcome. And Frank Herbert usually is someone that innovates each time he writes a Dune novel. So why are we being so fixated on the past? Beyond the redundancy of it, this instant worm farm idea really kind of blows a giant plot hole in the whole saga. I really feel like we've been told repeatedly in all the earlier novels that conditions on Arrakis were unique and that spice production just couldn't be replicated anywhere. There were some bad guys. Actually, book two, now that I'm thinking about it, they kidnapped a worm. They hauled it off somewhere. That their plan was this one. And nothing came of it, I assumed, because you can't do it anywhere else. Think about it. God Emperor Leto, he would not have been able to gain the monopoly on spice production that he did. He would not have been able to subjugate the entire universe to his will if somebody could just wet a maggot and turn a random planet into a competing spice factory. That just it negates the idea that he held all the cards. And since we're on the subject of that plausibility, can I also just point out, it's a little ridiculous that nobody in the entire universe in the last 5,000 years decided to pull their old Mac out of the closet, a computer or something. If you remember, the only reason why people are obsessed with spice and taking spice in such large amounts is because they need a drug that will help them think and act and work like machines. Because in this future, machines are outlawed. There was a cyber revolt, but Larian jihad, and so nobody at all touch a computer again. Which I get. Look, if your cell phone and your flat screen TV conspired to kill you, yeah, you take a couple decades off, maybe a century. You delete all your social media accounts. You go off the grid. But if your current situation is that you're begging a 30-foot psychotic worm to shit a tab of spice in your mouth so you can make it to Friday, maybe you just plug back into the 21st century for a little bit, let AI do some of your job. Just saying. Cyber attacks seem better than dictators and space whores and all of the problems that have come out of mankind's spice addiction. Nevertheless, it's not happening. People are still very reluctant to augment their bodies, to plug machines back in book six. And so they are growing new spice. It should be said, the enemy, the honored Matras, I mentioned them last time, the space whores. They have a machine that is making spice for them. And apparently it turns your eyes orange instead of the typical blue. So maybe that's also what makes them so sex crazy. I don't really know. You're supposed to treat it like brown acid at Woodstock. Nobody touch the orange spice. It's bad for you. It came out of machines. It's not organic. It's a real hippie Whole Foods philosophy to this, I suppose, as public safety issue. The Bene Gesserit, however, are convinced that they must restore spice production as it was, take this sandworm off the endangered species list. And so they are willing to tank their own ecosystem to do that. That's what's important here. Again, they live on Chapter House. It's a green, wonderful world. They've lived there for all this time. And now they are going to turn it into Arrakis too. Unfortunately for them, the oversexed Honored Matras enemies are not slowing down. Yes, they blew up Arrakis, and that was just the beginning of their universal conquest. As Book 6 is getting started, these space whores have destroyed more than 60 planets, and they've executed over 1,000 Reverend Mothers. And they're not going to stop until they find the secret Chapter House planet and destroy it and the worm and spice as well. I mentioned the Death Star earlier. I find that there really is a very Star Wars / Empire Strikes Back quality to this Book 6 setup. That the Bene Gesserit, they feel like the outmatched rebels who have gone into hiding in this inhospitable world. They're fearful of a planet-destroying weapon, which I look at the cover to my paperback, and I don't know how you don't think of the Death Star. There's a giant metal planetoid with a circular indentation, almost like a thumbprint on it, where I presume the laser pops out, I have accused Lucas in the past of taking some things from Frank Herbert and Dune, but it seems like Frank now is peeking over the shoulder of George and wondering how he can pass the test of pleasing sci-fi fans. It seems like he's run out of ideas and is now turning to Star Wars to fill in the gap. Which I say good. Steal more, actually. If there's a problem with Book 6, it's that he didn't rip Star Wars off enough, because this Chapter House Dune novel is a real snooze. So boring. It would really benefit from having some space opera verve to it. The pace of this storytelling has slowed to a crawl as we approach the finish line. At first, I thought this was a good thing, because if you recall last book, I had to restart it. I had to read it twice because it was such a frustrating, convoluted reading experience. I appreciated that now Frank Herbert is taking some more time with his characters. He's giving them understandable motivations and inner conflicts, and we're just allowed to know what's going on in a way that I couldn't hold on to last time. But for the first 100 pages, I actually think Chapter House Dune is doing a good job of setting up the central rivalry between two sisterhoods. On one side, we got, I guess we'll call them the good witches, the ones we've always known. Bene Gesserits, now being led by Mother Superior Dar. I think it's really funny that the first chapter has Dar making a clone of her own father. She's trying to birth her own dad. And she's laughing about that irony, too. But it's such a weird idea. The Bene Gesserit have taken the Ixion machines. They're breaking some laws there. But they are trying to make their own clones. They haven't had to do that in the past. But they really want, and specifically, to recreate Dar's father because he was Miles Teg, that war hero from the Atreides line, who was a big factor in Book 5. I didn't bring him up too much in the last show because, well, you have space whores and who can compete, but Miles Teg was a major player and a major hero, and he is a military genius who died a martyr at the end of that novel. And so, you know, this is what I was saying at the beginning. If he died at the end of the last book, let's just bring him back in the first chapter of the new book, like nothing ever changed. I get why they'd want him back, because the thinking is we're going to have to find a way to stop the Honored Matris, and they're going around the universe blowing up all these planets. They need somebody to have a counterstrike. And you know what? I probably shouldn't call them space whores anymore, because Dar actually has put an end to that language. She sees it as a slur that is not correct. When we look at the other side of this battle, I will go by their given name. The Honored Matris are being led by a wicked woman nicknamed the Spider Queen. And her real name is Dama, but she'll chew you out if you call her that, because Honored Matris actually conceal their real identities until the very moment that they want to change you. That their whole method is, again, why that you might call them space whores is they seduce men. And they get you into bed, and they're humping and grinding, and you're getting into the rhythm. And then once they lean into your ear and whisper their name, if she goes, "Hi, I'm Dama," that's it. Your mind is flipped. You're under their spell. You're going to do their bidding. So that's another reason why they're a threat. Not only are they blowing up planets, but when they encounter military men, POWs, they can, I guess, screw them into complicity. And so, yes. What makes women so evil in Frank Herbert's mind is that they have a strong sexual desire, that they use their bodies, not their minds, to influence people. I already called out in the last podcast that I think that's a little bit conservative and out of step. Even for 1985, when this book is being published, it feels like a sentiment that wouldn't be particularly positive or accepted in what typically has been a progressive series. I actually think it's hilarious. When we meet Spider Queen, she's actually screwing this monstrous man-cat hybrid called a Futar. And it makes me think of the Thundercats. They're bred, I believe, to hunt and devour Reverend Mothers. But they're also literal animals in bed. So again, if you're trying to demonize sex, Spider Queen having this feline with benefits relationship, it's even more funny to me because the Futars talk in broken caveman sentences, and the pillow talk is hysterical here. Want back rub, want eat. me no like 69. I mean, he didn't do the last one, but you get my point. Dopey as they are, I'm going to say, okay, you know what? This is the first 100 pages. It seems sillier. Frankly, this doesn't have the maturity that I usually expect in any previous Dune novel. But here's where we've landed. The Iron Mattress are book six villains, and I kind of love the stakes. I mean, when we see a character that was a big part of book five, Reverend Mother Lucilla, one of the heroes, she gets captured and killed by the Spider Queen in these first 100 pages. Again, that's a major player going down quick and dirty. It makes me wrongly think that Chapter House Dune is going to be risk-taking, that it's really dangerous, and that Frank Herbert has done a decent job of recreating the good and evil rivalry that he had going back to book one, you know, between House Atreides and House Harkonnen. Herbert has also pivoted away from something that I really didn't like in Heretics of Dune, the sexual exploitation of children, where so much of that book five plot was about these supposedly good witches breeding a 12-year-old girl named Chiana with another clone of Duncan Idaho. And fortunately, that didn't happen. That plan literally got screwed up. Before Duncan was introduced to Chiana, he was captured and seduced by an honored mattress. She had taken him to bed. She whispers, "I'm Mirbella," into his ear. And again, that's going to imprint her into his brain, and he's supposed to be under her control for all time. Although, we'll find out in a twist, he was also programmed to kill the first woman that took his virginity. And so you really think in the end of book five that there's going to be some blood in this bedroom scenario. It's about to get real violent. But Mirbella and Duncan have actually emerged from these throes of passion to be madly devoted to each other. They are in love, hardwired to be monogamous forever. They're making babies and making plans to never be with anyone else. And that is kind of good and bad news for the Bene Gesserit. On one hand, they had matchmaking plans that are totally derailed. Duncan won't even look at Chiana or any other woman now. But Duncan at least is still loyal to the Reverend Mothers. He treats them as his moral compass. And so if he's fallen in love with Mirbella and Mirbella is going to be loyal to him, maybe they can turn this honored mattress. Maybe they can take someone from the dark side, bring them into the good witches, and, you know, get her to tell secrets. Maybe she will have things to say about this enemy that they can use against them. That is, I would say, the major storyline in book six, that Mirbella and Duncan are imprisoned on this Bene Gesserit spaceship, and that Dar is trying to get secrets out of them. On one hand, she's trying to make Duncan her mentat, her, you know, I guess, advisor. While Mirbella, she is undergoing Bene Gesserit training. And again, they're thinking that she might trust them with things they can use against their enemy. But I'm going to go ahead and jump to the end of book six. Mirbella does join the crew. She does survive what is called the spice agony. We've seen that in the movies where they drink the water of life and they become the full Reverend Mother. She does that, but she also refuses to stop loving Duncan Idaho. They just imprinted on each other too deeply during the deflowering, and she's not going to let go. And that really is a quandary. I mean, it's a crime for a Bene Gesserit woman to fall in love with a man. And the reason for this really goes all the way back to book one. If you recall, Lady Jessica, she fell in love with Duke Leto and gave her man a son because he wanted that and she loved him. But her sisterhood wanted her to create a daughter that they could marry off to the House Harkonnen family. And because she loved her husband more than she listened to her sisterhood, things really got screwed up. Plans that they had made, the Bene Gesserit, they calculate family trees for centuries beyond the current moment. They put it on Jessica's love as the reason why the entire universe fell under the enslavement of a giant worm, that we wouldn't have gotten God Emperor Leto had she just been more loyal to her sisterhood and not loved a man so much. So again, that is sentenced to prison planet. If they find out that you love a man and aren't, you know, just using love as a manipulation, if you're being ruled by your emotions, you're kicked out of the club. So So there's a real question mark lingering around this Mirbella. On one hand, they need her, they want her, and she seems like she will be a good asset. But can they trust her to be loyal to these Bene Gesserit if she's going to stay loyal to Idaho? And there are some, it should just be said, that don't even like the fact that Duncan is still around. That he could be, like Paul, some kind of Kwisatz Haderach that will grow into a problematic leader, dictator. And there is an assassination plot. Some of the Reverend Mothers get together and attempt to assassinate Duncan Idaho. It ends up getting called off. But yes, these lovers are potentially assets and threats. Meanwhile, just worth pointing out that Shianna, the girl that was intended for Duncan, is perfectly content growing to womanhood as a single girl. She's kind of asexual. She never did really want to mate with a teenage clone anyway. Her real passion was worms. If you recall, all throughout Book 5, Shianna was commanding giant sandworms on Rakkus. They were giving her rides. They were obeying her beck and call. They really were her pet. And so she is spending Book 6 really focused on worms. As they're cultivating Chapter House into a desert planet, she's there hoping that the arid new climate is yielding healthy worms that are going to produce that natural spice. Readers might actually get the impression that Shianna is hostile towards Duncan. I know I did. As we're getting started here, it seems like bitter rivalry. But I'm going to just go ahead and jump to the end, because that's where the plot is. It's a big surprise that we'll find out in the end, these two are conspiring against the Bene Gesserit together. They're going to run away. Shianna is going to grab her baby worms, throw them in a shoebox or something, hijack the spaceship where Duncan is imprisoned, and they're going to jet off to some faraway land where they can be free. The idea is that nebulous. They don't really know what the future holds, but we know that Shianna does not want to be a Reverend Mother, and she longs, like Duncan, for her freedom. And frankly, I'm just going to say I share in Shianna's dissatisfaction. I, too, want to hop a spaceship and leave Chapter House Dune far behind. This is such an unpleasant novel. You'll notice that I kept saying I'm going to jump to the end of the book to explain things. And that is because nothing happens for hundreds of pages. The middle of this novel is mostly Reverend Mother Dar wandering around an apple orchard and just bemoaning her plight. Thinking about the past, worrying about the future. Will the new worms take to Chapter House? Will the clone of my father grow up and be as great a military leader? Should we trust Mirbella? Should we trust Duncan? A little of that is character development. 200 pages of that is tedium. And here's just a basic creative writing advice for you out there. If all your characters in your story are doing a lot of this kind of hand-wringing, you should probably not focus on that moment in time. Because it's not interesting. Tell the part of the story where they're actually doing something. Don't have a lengthy time where people are just griping and waxing nostalgic and thinking about what they might do in the future. I kid you not. There are 3 chapters devoted to Reverend Mothers raving about soup. Like, doesn't this clam chowder remind you of living by the sea as a child? And pages of this kind of soup analysis. I get that Dune takes in a multiple subject matter. We'll do anything. We'll explore politics, religion, ecology, physics. Fine, sure. But nobody comes here for the recipes, okay? We do not need to hear how great the bouillabaisse is on Chapter House. And at one point in the middle of this book, a character comes to Dar and just please, please pleads to her, I'm pumping my fist, do something, act. We need you to be our leader. And I'm like, hell yes. Please hear this message. And what does Dar do? I kid you not. She has another bowl of soup and then she hops on the subway and she travels to the other side of the planet so she can catch up with a friend. Which is like, no, chick, you are not getting it. Action does not mean taking more time to discuss what you want to do. It means rather than letting the big battle that's going to be everything happen in the last 50 pages, Maybe you put it here in the middle and you expand on that battle, because that's, again, action is what people care about. And while Doom novels can be philosophical, they should not just be neurotic. And I get it. All right. There is a reason why there are so many characters paralyzed with grief and uncertainty in this final book. Author Frank Herbert is living that life. He is in a very similar position with the recent loss of his own wife, Beverly. I mentioned this at the last show. She was his rock. She had been there during the writings of all the Dune novels. When he loses her to cancer in the fall of 1983, it must have felt like watching Arrakis be blown to bits. The whole world was over after losing her. And son Brian Herbert insists in the biography that he wrote about his father, Dreamer of Dune, that critics basically accused his dad of writing the letter Dune books for money. That his heart wasn't into it, that he was just into cashing big checks, and I'll be honest, I wondered the same thing as I was trying to get through this novel. This felt like unnecessary stalling. Brian insists that Frank loved spending time on Dune. He wanted to be here, he wanted to explore, but what he desperately needed, frankly, was a break. He wanted to write other things, he needed to recharge his creative batteries. Keep in mind, the distance between Dune Book 1 and Book 2 was for almost 5 years. Between Book 2 and Book 3, it was like 7 years. And he wrote lots of other things there. But because Frank is motivated, yes, by big checks, because the only thing that is really selling is Dune novels with Frank Herbert's name on it, yes, there will be no long breaks between Dunes. Again, this is coming 2 years after that last, what I would call, unsuccessful Heretics of Dune book. And he's got debts. Just a bit of information you wouldn't know unless you read the biography Dreamer of Dune. But Frank Herbert has been building a very large mansion on a Hawaiian island for the last 5 years. And his hope was that he and his wife Beverly could retire there. And as typically is the case in these things, construction went wildly over budget, and the IRS started calling about taxes. Beverly, I mean, it's so painful. She doesn't even live to see its completion. And again, I have to find a way to pay for all of this. And certainly not going to be coming from Hollywood. It's also worth pointing out, amid all of this other tragedy, the David Lynch film has been a huge Christmas 1984 flop. So everything that Frank Herbert was banking on, Oscars, lucrative merchandise tie-ins, his involvement in writing sequels, there is no acclaim, there is no more money. Frank must rush out a new Dune book, whether he feels inspiration for it or not. And to hear the son describe it, he really just wasn't into writing this novel and was experiencing terrible writer's block throughout this time period. So I get that the author was not in a great place to dazzle his audience. I'll even offer that grief can sometimes be a great theme to explore. I mean, think of Empire Strikes Back, the best Star Wars movie. Part of what makes it so intriguing is that the rebels are losing, that there is this darker exploration of the character's souls and that they're being hunted. I mean, I think you can take what Frank was feeling and apply it to his characters and have something really interesting, dramatically speaking. I think Frank Herbert was trying to do that, but what he ends up doing is crying into bowls of soup for pages and pages and pages, and making readers drink the broth. He hadn't had the proper distance to have perspective on his own loss, and so he couldn't offer anything for the character's loss either. The loss of Arrakis, the loss of life between the characters. It was stalling. I mean, this is a novel about people fretting and stalling. And perhaps the most disappointing thing about Chapter House Dune is that Frank Herbert wasn't thinking this was going to be the end. This wasn't designed to be the last Dune novel from him. He was going to keep having big paydays. It was his expectation to at least write a book 7, and he just didn't live to do that. So, unfortunately, he teases the ending of Chapter House Dune with a cliffhanger. We're just left with a lot of ambiguity about what is going to happen next. I'm going to go ahead and spoil it. I already told you I don't like to tell you the end of books when I'm doing the podcast, but it's not much of an ending anyway, and this is the last show, so let me just get to it. Okay, so we have this epic space battle that comes in the last 50 pages, as I mentioned, in which the reborn Miles Tegg clone, who was once a great military leader and is now like a 10-year-old brat, but somehow he's leading an army of millions against the honored Mottress. And it seems like he's winning. It seems like he's still got the skills. He's still able to strategize, and he breaks down their defenses, and it seems like a pretty decisive defeat. And then you realize it was a trap, that Reverend Mother Dar gets killed, and it seems like Mirbella, who was the honored Mottress who had taken the Bene Gesserit classes, she was now turning around and betraying the sisterhood and returning to her roots. And wow, that's really dark. This thing has gone black as midnight, but nope. Then she betrays the Spider Queen and kills her as well. And essentially, this makes her the head of both factions. Not unlike Paul Atreides at the end of book one, Mirbella suddenly is lined up to be Reverend Mother, Honored Mottress, leading them all, and insisting that the two warring women make good. Like, literally, she tells them, you're going to love each other. That is my decree as your new ruler, is that you must hug it out. Love is not something the Bene Gesserit do. If I haven't made that clear already, they are definitely not going to love an enemy that is blowing up their worlds. And the Space Wars, you know, maybe they'd be up for a big gangbang or something, but they're not going to be in the same room as their enemy and not display aggression. So you got two very vocal groups that are listening to their new leader and saying, not going to do it. And so the ending of this novel is that all the dissenters get on the spaceship with Shianna and Duncan, that I mentioned already, those two were going to run off together. They throw in a whole lot of other people. We got Miles Tegg, the kid military leader. We got some really pissed off Bene Gesserit sisters. We've got a tribe of Jewish people. This was an interesting addition, but somehow Frank Herbert wanted to work in here that Judaism has survived through all this time, and that we have a rabbi and his daughter taking their secret knowledge and, you know, Jewish tradition, the Torah, all of that stuff, and taking it into outer space with all these other characters. Seidel, the face dancer villain from book two, is somehow the last living Bene Talaxiu. He's getting on board the ship too, and he's carrying a whole bunch of genetic material in his pocket, which leads you to believe that, well, wouldn't you know it, he's going to regrow House Atreides, because everything old must come back again, because the Bene Talaxiu actually were the only group that liked being under the rule of the worm. They actually believed his hype. They thought he was a god. And so I'm assuming Seidel is going to grow Paul, or maybe his son Leto again, bringing them back from the dead, and we'll just have the same story we did in book four. I don't know. Chapter for House Dune, it leaves Mirbella eating soup. I kid you not, this is like the last image. She's eating soup on the Bene Gesserit homeworld, talking about restoring old emperor values, and her enemies are flying away with the worm. Why it's really a problem for her. It'd been one thing if they had just said goodbye, we don't like you, but they took away her ability to make natural spice, and it sounds like she wants to get them, and maybe even violently. And that's how it ends. She's going to get them. And we don't know what that looks like or how that will be, because there was supposed to be a book seven to answer that. And no, Frank Herbert does not live to write it, sadly. His son Brian, he just believed his dad couldn't live without Beverly, that he lacked purpose, that his last year on life was really a tragic downfall. It started really with some mania that Frank had gone on book tour for book five and fallen in love with his 20-something publicist and bought her a Porsche, and they got engaged. They were making honeymoon plans to hike Mount Everest together, which is, I just want to remind you, this is a 65-year-old man with some real big health problems. And then he gets a cancer diagnosis and everything just stops. Frank stops the wedding, he stops writing, he stops eating. He is this grand tall man that just shrinks down to almost 100 pounds, emaciated in bed. They do try a series of painful surgeries But within a matter of months, he goes from this manic, I'm going to live forever, to dying of a pulmonary embolism 1 year after the publication of Chapter of House Doom, actually. And he leaves us all with sadness. My sadness, first and foremost, obviously, for the Herbert children, who it had to hurt like hell to lose both your parents so quickly and in such a undignified way. And then I grieve for Herbert, you know, who has, in my estimation, really tarnished his sci-fi epic, that he had something really good going with those first four novels. And then this last book and this really rushed, uninspired coda, we know he can do better. The fans deserve better. I'm sad for us as well, because here I am, after exploring and finding such juicy insights into so many ideas with all these books, just sifting through sand, having almost nothing to say about Chapter House Doom. I'm convinced it probably wouldn't have even been finished, except that Beverly Herbert, on her deathbed, made Frank promise that he was going to do that for her, that she knew he wanted to write after book five, allegedly her favorite book in the series, and that she said, "Promise you won't let my death slow you down in writing that book." So even though he wanted to take a lot of time and had no ideas, he pushed through for her. I guess it's a credit to him, you know, that out of a begrudging sense of duty, he got to some kind of ending, even though it was not fueled by urgency or passion. And that's kind of how I feel, duty bound. I'm here making this podcast because I made a promise to you listeners that I was going to cover all six books, damn it. And if I have to force my eyeballs through all of these maddening, dull, 433 miserable pages and formulate some kind of exasperated review, I guess I'm done. God knows I wanted to give you a happier conclusion here, and I'm happy it has concluded. But yeah, it truly was a spice agony this time to cross the finish line. And so, yikes. I sincerely want to thank you. It has been a very bumpy journey for me. I benefited because I knew that there were those out there who had sent encouraging words and shared their enthusiasm about what I was doing in this very strange, spicy literary universe unlike any other I've ever read. You wanted to know more. I wanted to know more. It helped me to get to an end because God knows I can't tell you how many times I wanted to put down this book and not even read another word. But it is because of you that I'm here saying we've done it. The mission is complete. And if you're asking me final thoughts, the easy conclusion is to say stop after book four, right? The first novel is great. The next two are hit and miss, but definitely worth reading. And book four is a wild ride. I really think it's an interesting one. Whether you love it or hate it, you'll be glad that you took that journey. But I didn't gain anything from spending time on these last two Dune installments. And the question is, I can't believe I'm asking it, did I read too much or am I stopping too early? Because, all right, hold your hats. 20 years after the publication of Chapter House Dune, you know, we're left on this cliffhanger. What's Mirbella going to do? Where are all these people in a spaceship going to go eat? Where can they even exist? Answers are given. Brian Herbert, apparently he has found a treasure trove of his father's notes that were written about book seven, and he had his own ideas as well. He had spent decades cultivating his voice as a writer, and he writes not one, but a two-part book conclusion that answers all of our supposed questions. Is it possible? I mean, is it possible that 2006 Hunters of Dune or 2007 Sandworms of Dune could redeem the absurdity of book five, the doldrums of book six? Do I dare promise you listeners two more podcasts to find out? I'm tempted, but listen, I am going to do something that Frank Herbert didn't have the luxury of doing. I am going to take a very long Dune break. I need it. I really feel like I don't want to hear another thing about this until Denis Villeneuve releases his third Dune movie. And maybe by that point, it's not a promise, I'm not saying I'm doing it, but maybe I will read those two books, and either on that movie review show, or if I'm feeling wild and crazy, in podcasts just like the one I'm finishing here, I will tell you my thoughts on how the literary saga wound up not in Frank Herbert's vision, but Brian Herbert's vision. But we got other things to read right now. I want to point out, Now Playing is getting back to Stephen King. In just another month or so, we are going to cover his Bag of Bones 2011 TV miniseries, which prompts me to say I need to be reading his 1998 novel. Also, I don't want to spoil any surprises, but the Summer Fall donation drive has some literary connections to it that I need to explore. So frankly, I just need to read other things. Not only do I want to step away from the Duneverse, but the movies are begging me to do so. And so I don't know what the next Now Playing book review will be, or whether I'll even be the host for it. But I do want to thank you. Thank you for being such a loyal supporter, for being a good listener. I hope you've enjoyed my 7-year sojourn in the sand. Keep reading, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to Now Playing Podcast Book Reviews. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast. In the archives at nowplayingpodcast.com, you can find more than 150 more book reviews, including many of the works of Stephen King, the Ian Fleming Bond books, the Planet of the Apes novels, Frank Miller's The Dark Knight Returns, and many more. This episode of Now Playing Podcast Book Reviews is copyright 2024, Venganza Media Incorporated, all rights reserved. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, redistributed, or modified without the express permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.